Welcome to On Being Happier, Thinking with Heart and Mind, a podcast emphasizing the heart's role in happiness, in sound decision-making, and in being at our best. Hi, my name is Ron Schneebaum. I'm a physician, work at the outpatient arm of the Children's Hospital at Dartmouth, and serve on the clinical faculty at Dartmouth College's Geisel School of Medicine. I'm convinced that nothing's more important to the human psyche than love. I have worked at thinking with both heart and mind for over 40 years. While intellectual analysis generally carries the banner of thinker, to leave out the heart is to leave out something vital. Language reminds us of the importance of the heart. To do something half-heartedly, or to not put our hearts into an activity, means we didn't do it well. And to be heartless is not a compliment. We involve our hearts wherever we care the most. Where heart and mind work together, we are happier, have richer relationships, and greater practical success. We are fully present, and we are fully ourselves. It's the art of living well. Each episode of this podcast presents a different side of thinking with heart and mind. Together, I hope they paint a full and broad picture. I developed this podcast to not only describe a lost art, but to also offer challenges and tools that interested listeners can use to incorporate thinking with the heart into all aspects of their lives. The ideas in this podcast are my own, and its stories have been altered to protect privacy. This podcast is not a substitute for medical advice. If you are experiencing significant difficulties, please seek professional help. I thank you for joining me on this venture. My very best and be well, Ron. Episode 2, Lead with the Heart. I tell the medical students I teach that one of our jobs is to give each patient we see a present. They look at me a little puzzled, so I talk to them about gift giving. When we give a present to someone we care about, we think about them, we think about the event, and we think about what they would like. Our enjoyment not only comes from their thanks, but it comes from knowing that we gave them something they can use and that they would like. Our patients travel great distances to come to us. Some of them, actual physical distance, and others go through the mental, emotional processes of going to a doctor. And they come with their burdens, with their worries and their concerns. Our gift is to address these concerns, and to give them this present, we have to get to know them. The way that I do this in my office is by going over their medical record. I look at my last visit with them. I look at their current and ongoing problems. I look at any medications they might be taking. And I also read the notes of subspecialists they might have seen. After this preparation, I'm ready to go into the room. Sick visits are similar, but they have an extra twist to them. I get a little notation that describes why they're coming to see me. It might say something like shortness of breath. To prepare myself, I again go over their chart, see if they have any problem that might be related to shortness of breath, and then I think about the causes of shortness of breath that are most likely, given their age, given the season, given their medical problems. I add to this the wide range of causes of shortness of breath. That's something physicians call a differential diagnosis. It goes from serious problems to the shortness of breath that comes from being out of shape and trying to do a sport. With all this in mind, I go into the room and think about what I want to ask about and what I want to look for to let me know if somebody has a serious problem that needs immediate attention. This kind of effort is the work any good physician goes through. When we lead with the heart, we take this a step further. We try to imagine the visit from the patient's perspective. And this includes trying to imagine the worries and concerns that someone might have but not ask. When I go to a well visit, I sometimes hear a concern. I saw a couple recently, for example, who were pointing out the differences between their two young children. One was incredibly active and darting all around the room, and the other sat quietly on the floor playing. They pointed out how different they are, And then they said something about how we know that we shouldn't be comparing our children. Hearing that, I know that there is a common thought out there that it's bad to compare your children. So I thought I would address that because I'm fascinated by the idea of individual differences. I say to them, of course you'll compare them. You compare a rainy day to a sunny day. The only difference with children is you can't like one better than another. And then I point out that we have these same differences as adults. We just don't see them. If we asked three people to spend 2 weeks to study mountains, one of these might go to the library or to the internet to learn everything they possibly could about mountains. Another might pack up camping equipment and spend those 2 weeks hiking and living in the mountains, while a third might carry an easel and papers and brushes and paint the mountains for 2 weeks. When they came back, they'd all learned something about mountains that they hadn't known before, but their style, approach, and interests were completely different from each other. Another way that I think about individual differences has to do with the nature-nurture question, and I share my latest thoughts with parents. I say, you know, I think what happens is it's akin to having a garden. There's the corn and the peas and the carrots and the tomatoes. We didn't make them into what they are. Our job is to be the sunshine, to nurture them, to allow them to grow maximally to their fullest potential. When I see teenagers for visits, I try to think about what I could add that would be helpful for them, if not immediately, maybe at some other point in their life. It's so easy to tell teenagers what they should do and what they shouldn't do, but to say something that they can take as a gift, something they can use later, takes working with the heart as well. I say, listen, it's not my job to tell you what to do and what not to do. I have some thoughts. If you're interested, I'd be more than happy to share them. But what I can say is trust yourself. You have certain feelings about what's right for you and what's not. Stick by those. If you're ever in a situation where somebody pushes you to change your mind, that's never the time to change your mind. You're always allowed to rethink. You're always allowed to change your mind. But generally, when you're pressured by somebody else to do that, that's never a good time to make that change. And then I give an example. I say, suppose you're standing at a cliff, and down below is a pool, and a friend wants you to jump with them over the edge and down into the pool. They really aren't interested in your well-being. They know that they would like to go, and it's a lot more fun for them if you join them. When I see children and teenagers for sick visits, I also think about how I can imagine certain problems from their perspective and to address the questions they haven't even asked. Once a week or once every other week, a parent brings an infant or a young child into my office because they find a bump on their skull or on their neck. These are small, pea-sized little masses that don't hurt and wiggle around. I tell them that these are lymph glands, that they're not a problem, and that they are very common in young children. They're part of the body's immune system. Why they sometimes get large isn't clear to me, but it's very common that they do. So again, I say in young children, the ones that wiggle around, the ones that are pea-sized, and the ones that don't hurt aren't a problem and are never a problem. I then think a little bit further, and I think about why did they come to see me, because there was a bump. And I realize that probably it's because of a worry about cancer. And then I also think that when I mention the word lymph node, I might heighten that even more. I tell them that these are not precursor to cancer. They're bumps under the skin that are part of the immune system that are no different than, in some way, the nose being a bump under the skin. We don't need to worry about them at all. And then I talk a little bit about lymph glands. I say the reason that we associate lymph glands with cancer is not because, in general, they themselves are cancerous. It's more because they're used as a measurement. If someone has a cancer that spreads to the lymph gland, it describes that it's gone outside of its own capsule into neighboring structures. That would be akin to saying if I scratch my cheek on a tree branch and it almost went to my eye has nothing to do with the scratch. It's simply a marker for how far that scratch extended. Some teenagers who come to me with knee pain actually have a problem just below the kneecap. The big muscle at the front of the thigh, the quadriceps, ends in a large tendon that goes over the kneecap and attaches to the bone where they have the pain. When the quadriceps muscle tightens, it pulls on the tendon and that pulls on the lower leg, and that's what straightens it. The tendon is stronger than the immature bone in these young athletes, and it rips at the bone, causing microfractures and a painful swelling. While this sounds very serious, it's extremely rare for this to lead to a serious problem. Discomfort is the chief issue. I explain that to them. Then I go a little bit further, trying to imagine the worries that a teenager might have about this. And I also use this as a teaching moment. I point out to them that after resting or the next morning is when it hurts the most, and they agree. And then I tell them that in general, if they have a pain that hurts the next day, usually those are not very serious. Sometimes they might need to taper their activity so that it doesn't hurt so much, but they don't generally lead to long-term consequences. That I contrast to a pain that hurts while they're playing. And I tell them that if something hurts while you're playing, that's your joint saying, listen, there's something wrong here. Please get this checked out before you do further damage. I then think even a little bit further, and I think that some of these young people hope to be athletes later in their life. I let them know that the problem that they have will resolve once their bones mature. It will no longer hurt, and they will no longer have a problem. Taking it even further, I have them bend their leg and show them that their concern is really outside the knee joint. It's not a knee problem. It's really a problem of the lower leg. The reason I go through this effort is because I want to be the best physician I can possibly be. It's my job. Beyond that, there's joy in knowing that I helped someone. And that goes two ways. There's the intellectual part and trying to sort out what their problem is and appropriately treating it. And there's also the joy in knowing that I reached another human being and gave them something that they would find helpful. I tell these stories because it parallels what happens in everyday life. In my office, I go through a scheduled day, and at each appointment, I need to be as fresh as possible. I can't say to someone, what a shame you came in at 3 o'clock. I was so terrific at 11. Boy, you really missed it. I'm sorry. No, I need to be present for each and every person. They deserve my fullest attention no matter when they come in. In my regular life, I also have a schedule to my day. And just as in my office where I sometimes have emergencies, at home, unexpected things occur. I was opening my front door when a neighbor came by to tell me that my next-door neighbor had just been diagnosed with Lou Gehrig's disease. Lou Gehrig's disease, also known as ALS, is the illness that killed the Yankee great. It's characterized by paralysis, and chiefly by paralysis of the muscles that we need to use for breathing. Norm was in his late 70s, he lived by himself, and seemed like an incredibly nice guy. We had a neighborly relationship. While we lived next door to each other, we were never in each other's homes. We'd chat on the outside, we were very friendly, but it was really kind of a cordial relationship. I realized that I needed to think how I want to approach the upcoming death of my next-door neighbor. I couldn't ignore it, and I really wanted a plan. I wanted a plan that was the right thing to do, and that would be one that when I looked back later, I would feel good about my approach. I had nothing to go by, I just had to think this through. I realized that if somebody is dying of a progressive neurological disease, that there'll be a shut-in, and that shut-in's like company, so I thought I should visit him. On the other hand, I thought that I needed to not feel like my life should be about visiting him. I needed to also live my regular life. I could be at home if I want and read and not feel guilty that I should be next door. We weren't that close. I then thought about, how do I spend my time there? And it seemed to me that someone who's not able to get outside would simply like the company of others. So I thought I need to do nothing more than just be present. I did that, and Norm was incredible. He told me once that he had a very aggressive form of the illness, and his mood didn't change. He was calm, he was steady, he was strong. You wouldn't know that he was dying just by speaking to him. When he did speak, however, he had to move the oxygen mask off of his face that he needed so that he could get enough oxygen to breathe, and it was not easy for him. I then realized that I did have something to offer. I could say, listen, I'm a physician, I'm next door, anytime you ever need me, don't ever hesitate. And I also realized that I could listen to whatever he told me or whatever his family discussed. Because I was a physician, I'm used to dealing with death and tragedies. Norm didn't have any religious material around the house, so I didn't know how he felt about religion or spirituality. And because he never mentioned it, I didn't think it was my job to necessarily mention it. We were just two people who would talk together, and I was open to discuss anything he wanted to discuss. During this period of time, I became friendly with his children. He had three daughters and a son. One lived nearby, two lived reasonably far away, and one lived in Thailand. They'd each spend a significant period of time with him and then go back. I got to be close with them, so close that one day one of his daughters asked if she could speak with me. She lived in the Southwest and told me she'd been having a hard time with her husband and was considering getting a divorce. She said, you know, I always discuss things like this with my dad, and he's so helpful, but I don't know what to do now. I don't want to bother him in my last days. I listened and realized I couldn't possibly answer her question, but what I could say is, you love him, and he loves you. You have a wonderful relationship. Do what seems right to you. Don't be afraid. He's your dad. Just do what you need to do. You can't do anything wrong. And I think she appreciated that. Norm worsened. He went to a palliative care facility. I visited him there. And later, after he passed, I was so glad that I had chosen the route I had taken. I felt like I really was at my best and in the most appropriate way. I went to visit a friend who had lived in the neighborhood and had recently moved away. While I was there, they told me that they were going to a birthday party at the next-door neighbor's, whose 5-year-old son was having a celebration. They asked me if I wanted to join them. I had just gotten there, so I didn't feel like going home, so I said sure. I quickly realized that I really had no connections with anyone there. They knew a few of the friends of this couple, and they were all younger. My children at this time were grown and out of the house, and these were all young parents. I wondered how I would spend my time, and then when I was in the kitchen, I saw a plate with cut vegetables and meats that looked ready for the grill. The grill was in a little alcove off the kitchen, and I imagined that the hosts would be doing the grilling. I thought they'd rather be with their friends than having to stay in this alcove separate from everyone else, so I said, I've got the grill. And I went out there and cooked. I had a great time. I enjoy cooking, and it was a pleasure knowing that people were enjoying it and he could enjoy the birthday party of his son. I didn't have to do this, but it just seemed like the right thing to do. If it turns out I met somebody else and sat down and chatted, that would have been fine also. I don't want it to seem like leading with the heart is only about sacrifice. A colleague invited me to her son's wedding, and I was very surprised that I was invited because we weren't particularly close. I didn't know anybody at the wedding, and again wondered how I would spend my time. I thought of my friend who invited me, and I thought of her son and his bride, and imagined that what they would like to see is that people had a good time at their wedding. So I said, okay, I can do that. I can enjoy myself. To show that I'm having a good time, I would enjoy the people at my table, and I would dance. I did that and had a great time at the wedding. I developed this podcast to not only share my thoughts on thinking with heart and mind, but also to give listeners tools that they can use to incorporate thinking and leading with the heart in their everyday lives. To that end, I've developed some exercises for interested listeners. Think about the relationships you have and the activities you have during your day. Start with the ones that happen early in the morning and carry you all the way through. In which ones of these do you work at being your best? Any? All? Some? Just consider these. Don't add any guilt or bad feelings or anything like that. Just simply observe. The second part of the exercise is to consider what would it mean from your perspective in each of those situations to be at your best. Now, sometimes being at our best has outer demands. It means not being late to work. It means remembering to pick up our kid at school. It means stopping off at the grocery store on the way home. And all the realities of life that ask us to act in a certain way. There also is the inner dimension. It's us deciding how we want to be as a spouse, as a parent, as a friend, as a colleague, as a neighbor, and through all the relationships of our lives. When we sort these out, we take everything that we've learned about life, but ultimately, we need to find who we are and what we think. It's a great little tale by Martin Buber, the educator and philosopher. He described at the end of a great rabbi's life that this Rabbi Zusia said, "When I go to the other side, they will not ask me, 'Why were you not like Moses?' No, they will ask me, 'Why were you not like Zusia?'" I plan on posting new podcasts the 1st and 15th of each month. That leaves a 2-week break between this podcast and the next one. Use that time to think about leading with your heart. If you're streaming podcasts and you're listening to one after another, pause, if you'd like. Think about this question. Think about where you're at your best and what you imagine being at your best is like. This work alone brings results. Just pondering it without acting. On the other hand, if you put your thoughts into action, that will bring about results even sooner. To help with this challenge, I created certain tools for listeners. In the show notes, I detail what this challenge is, and you can download it and read it. In addition, in the show notes, I include several quotations that listeners might find interesting and inspiring. I hope you like them. At the podcast webpage at ronschnabaummd.com, I also have a picture with the words "Lead with the Heart" in it. This picture is in two sizes, one smaller and one larger. They can be downloaded and used as screensavers for your laptop or tablet, and they can also be used as wallpaper for your phone. I find that having these words in front of me while I'm working on a topic is a helpful reminder, and it keeps me on track. Also at the webpage, there's a place where you can leave your comments, questions, and suggestions. I won't be able to answer every question specifically, but I'll read all of them, and the ones that I don't answer or can't address will be material for future podcasts. In addition, if any of the topics raised in this podcast or in the previous one or in future ones are interesting enough to you that you'd like to go further, I can develop webinars. If that strikes you as something you'd like to do, please also leave a message. If you like this podcast, share it with anyone you think might be interested, with friends, with colleagues, with anyone else. In addition, go to the homepage where you listen to podcasts, rate it and review it. That's how podcasts get known. I've enjoyed spending this time with you. I look forward to talking with you again soon. Until then, all my very best and be well, Ron.